Hi, welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is the other thing I do. My guest this week is Stuart Hughes, an actor you might know from the films This Beautiful City, Small Town, Murder Songs, and It, or from his appearances on Blood and Water, Killjoys, Republic of Doyle, Murdoch Mysteries, and the final season of Orphan Black. And he co-stars with Richard Clarkin in The Drawer Boy, which is now streaming on Highball.tv after a theatrical run last month. Stuart chose Days of Heaven, Terrence Malick's 1978 drama set on the Texas Panhandle around 1916. Richard Gere and Brooke Adams are Bill and Abby, a couple who pose as brother and sister to move through the world unnoticed. But when Bill points Abby at Sam Shepard's wealthy but ailing farm owner in an attempted grift, a phony courtship turns into something more and gradually poisons everyone's relationships. It's all witnessed by Bill's young daughter Linda, played by the unknown Linda Manns, whose narration gives the events a lyrical texture they probably don't deserve. It's a rapturous work from a filmmaker of profound talent, and 40 years later, it still stirs the heart and soul in ways I don't fully understand. But Stuart can tell you. This is someone else's movie.
I think when I first saw it, I was sort of awed by it, and just sort of immediately fell in love with it. You know, and I think the obvious thing is, and you hear everybody talk about it, you know, is the look of the film. I just found myself taken by that splendor, the cinematographer's work and his desire and love of, you know, that natural lighting, that magic hour. It just sort of drew me in. But it was also, there was a, something at play that I noticed, and I felt more than anything, and have been able to articulate as an observer more seeing it again.
Right. Yeah.
And that maybe the performances and the restraint in particularly, I would say Shepard's performance.
Yeah.
At first I found it, you know, Sam Shepard's performance was, I was immediately maybe more drawn to Richard Gere. I was a young man when I saw it. I think I was in university at the time, you know, performance major, and, you know, Gere was, his performance was much more, in a way, to me at the time, confident.
Right. It's livelier, right?
I mean, livelier. He's more visceral, you know, strapping kind of a young man. Hard scrabble kind of type.
Yeah.
And, but when we first meet Shepard in the film, he's very reserved and his performance is very understated and withdrawn almost. And unlike maybe the persona that we have of him now or have had of him now, as he's grown older and, you know, he's a bit of a tough old cuss, you know, and,
he's the Western.
He's the Western,
right? Like,
figure,
as in our memory.
That's right.
And what was Right Stuff was maybe 5 years away.
Yes, right.
But yeah, and seeing him as this sort of gentlemanly, this young, uncertain, hesitant person, and then, yeah, compounding it with the fact that he's dying and he won't acknowledge it to anyone.
That's
just,
right.
He doesn't seem to be ill. He's just very still and very removed.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
He sort of a eggshell-like quality to him that I found, and I think it maybe even bothered me. I kind of didn't get it maybe at first, but now when I see the film or when I've seen it since that original viewing, I kind of just am struck between all the main characters in it and their being able to complement one another.
Yeah, the give and take of it is really something.
Yeah. And then as I sort of look at it even more, so I find the tension of it is, I think, what I'm drawn to, but without being obvious. So that, you know, immediately you start off with that, the stills, those great sort of black and white stills of the, you know, almost Jacob Riis-like things, photographs, but then that set up that industrial sort of Chicago or industrial city, industrial New York, And then you get right into the immediate, that steel melting plant, and the violence that instantly happens there. And then you're set up. And then they start taking the kind of cuts to a quick Piedmont kind of a blues thing that you go, oh yeah, here we go, we're going into a hobo like world, and the train going across the track, and you see them arrive into the open west, the wild, you know, what is these beautiful fields.
The sort of that unspoiled naturalistic thing that Malick uses constantly, but
yeah,
that everyone thinks of Days of Heaven.
That's right.
I didn't want to derail you this, but what surprised me this time through was how elliptical it is, how there's no connective tissue. It's just drifting from one thing to the next. But it reassemble a narrative in our minds, so it sounds much more linear when you're talking about it, but we're with them flowing through these moments, and
it almost feels like sort of a depression Tom Sawyer's in a way, that you fall, you go down this river of events that culminate in obviously what is
like a
tragic end,
like a mythical American story happening in front of us live, instead of being told to us. We're watching the myth happen, we're watching it form, because it's being remembered through a child, a younger kid anyway.
And that narration,
the amazing Linda Mann.
That narration is unbelievable, that young actor, Linda Mance.
Yeah, she's fantastic.
And apparently they did, as he was, trying to edit it, it took like, 2 years or something, and he wasn't quite getting what he wanted, and then he went and had her sit down and watch it, and apparently they got about, somebody told me, like 60 hours or something of narration.
I can believe that. His process is so fascinating. It's weird, too. We seem to be doing, people are bringing his movies to this show in chronological order.
Are they?
Yeah. Becky Johnson picked Badlands about a year and a half ago. And now this.
Yeah.
And people have been hinting that they want to do The Thin Red Line. And we almost did a Tree of Life episode last year, but it didn't happen. So it's almost like the organizational principle is beyond me. It's just the cosmos is going to drop a Terrence Malick movie on me every year.
Right.
And it's great because it spaces them out in a way. And I get to revisit them in chronological order, and realize this time through that he's always done this thing. I kept thinking, The Thin Red Line has the illusion of being a narrative film because it's a war movie, and there are battles and there's a sequence of events, and Days of Heaven is a straight line as well, but they're not really about the events that happen chronologically. They're about the way that people experience them and the memories thereof. So we're kind of floating back and forth in time, even when the movie's moving in a straight line.
Right.
And watching Days of Heaven this time through, I realized just how little exposition there is, just how little concern there is for what's happening. Mm-hmm. It's all about what people are feeling.
Yes.
And in this incredible created world.
I find with a lot of his work, how I approach it, and I do this with certain plays that you get into the theater, or you get into a museum and see a piece of work, and sometimes with certain things you just have to let them sort of wash over you and just let them flow through you, and then something happens, but it's not in a direct way, it's in a subtler way. And in for me has those kinds of experiences have a longer have more of a longevity with me,
sure,
both emotionally and then intellectually. I begin to sort of see things in the piece, which is what happened with Days of Heaven. I think almost immediately the first thing that happens, the first bit of text aside from the narration, is somebody says, that beautiful farm manager, a guy, Robert Wilk.
Oh, yes.
Face the shoe leather. He sort of says, they get off the train, and he says to the young Richard Gere, can you sack or something? And Gere says, you can see he's lying. He goes, yes.
Yeah.
And immediately what happens for me in the film is that lie and the
where it's going. Yeah. You can talk about
the, you can, yeah, the lie and the murder that happened in the accident that happened in Chicago.
Oh, that's a murder. He kills him.
Yeah.
He straight up beats him to death.
But I think it was accidental. you know, I think...
Didn't intend to, maybe.
He really
wanted to hit him.
No, he wanted to hit him, there's no doubt, but I think he didn't want it necessarily to put him
out. Sure, yeah, I think we're introduced to him as someone who can't control his temper, mm-hmm. and also has a really strong moral code, which is bizarre.
Yeah.
Because he thinks he's defending his honor whenever he's doing something cruel or horrible.
Right.
But he keeps doing it.
No.
Yeah.
But that lie, I think, sets... It's like a Greek myth, then, or a Greek story.
Yeah, sure.
You can feel it all of a sudden start to happen. The inevitable is not going to be pretty. And, yeah. of course, it isn't. And I think not only that lie, but in a way, Sam Shepard's characters lie. He's lying to himself.
Sure.
That farm manager, that ranch manager says to him, there's something wrong with those people. And he dismisses it.
Yeah, no.
And he won't see it for what it is, that they're about ready to try and bamboozle him.
Mm-hmm. But it's a fascinating plan, because it's a terrible plan. I mean, on its face, it's an awful plan. It is transparent. Everyone will see through it.
Yeah.
Brooke Adams is incredibly conflicted about what is being asked of her. Yeah. But at the same time, it's a lie that makes everyone feel better. Like it's a comforting scam in a really strange way.
I think because it's hopeful.
Yeah,
there is hope that these people who you can see are coming from the underbelly of an ugly city
mm-hmm.
might actually have a shot at something.
Yeah,
even though they're going about it in the most dastardly way.
Yeah, and it's making a dying man happy.
Ah,
although they don't know he's dying yet, but. The sense of that they're taking advantage of him by giving him something he wants and that he genuinely lives up to his side of the bargain over the course of the film, it just makes it sadder and sadder. And watching it start is the worst part now emotionally because we know how it ends on second and third and fourth viewings.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is the weirdest thing. I think Malick knows. I think the editing is telling us that. Like there's no artifice in the way the film is constructed, even though it's a completely constructed movie. Mm-hmm. It's a period film. It's edited to within an inch of his life to be this experience.
Yes.
But it feels natural and evocative and gentle and deeply, deeply emotionally involved.
Yes.
And I still don't know how he does that in this specific film. I always remember it as being much longer than it is.
Yeah.
And not in a negative way.
No, no.
Not slow, just... I always think it's 2.5 hours, and it turns out to be 93 minutes.
Uh-huh.
You just soak in it. You steep in it.
Yes, you steep in it, don't you?
Yeah.
I know there's an image I have, one of the first images you have, again, of the farmer, of Shepard, mm-hmm. Sam Shepard, is him standing on top of the roof, or it's the windmill.
Yeah, just overseeing the world.
Yeah, overseeing the events that start to happen around that. And that house that he lives in, in that background, in that surrounding, which is nothing but field,
mm-hmm.
is like a monument, in a way.
Yeah,
and it stands there like both an image of prosperity, but also of doom in a way. You know, for me, and
like a tomb for him,
like a tomb a for him, tomb. And that windmill goes up, and then finally at the end when he sees. The brother, what he thinks of, or has been told, the brother and sister actually kissing out in the outside the shed. You see Sam Shepard witness it. That thing is going right behind him, and you can see it just ratcheting him up, and it has that sort of. But it's a very it's placed so naturally
mm-hmm.
that you go don't go. Oh, this is a device. This is it is a part of the world.
Yeah,
and I love films like that. You know, I love, you know, the clothes lived in, you know, and that there's a gal who did those who's Patricia Norris, I think was her name. And she did also things like McCabe and Mrs. Miller.
Right. There's a sense of like.
Yeah. 12 Years a Slave. Yes. Then, you know, I know that what she did was she would get old cloth, old materials, and then build the costumes out of that.
Mm-hmm. So it's not distressing costumes, it's building costumes that are already distressed.
Yeah. And, you know, I remember talking to Wayne Robson, who worked on, say, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and they just had racks and racks of clothes, and the actors would come and then build costumes themselves. And Altman would say, go, you create it. Yeah. And then they lived in it, and they built that structure in that particular film right there through the course of the making of the film.
Yeah, it's amazing to think about making... I mean, I'm always struck by the idea that if you move the camera 2 feet in any direction in a period film, you'll catch a guy in a t-shirt, you know, with a cigarette.
Yeah.
And then you hear about movies like Unforgiven, where Eastwood banned cars.
Yes.
People had to come to set on horseback because he didn't want any sign of trails in the snow.
Right.
No tire tracks.
Yeah.
And then you think about Malick and his... I don't know if it's fair to call it obsessive. It's just how he works, yes. Right? It's his approach. And because he won't talk about it himself... I mean, I've interviewed Martin Sheen and Jessica Chastain and people who've worked with him, and nobody wants to talk about it. And it's not in a negative, protective way. They just don't want to go there.
Yeah.
And so he's this incredible mystery. And I know that he's working with humans from the 1970s in this movie. You're surrounded by them. Mm-hmm. Gere couldn't be like more contemporary if you tried. It's just the way he holds himself.
Yes.
But... it casts the spell. The finished film makes you believe that they went to 1914 and shot it somehow, or 1922, whenever it's set. There isn't a single thing in it that feels out of place.
No.
And that's the costumes, and that's the production design, and the music, and the cinematography. And it's just, Brooke Adams looks like a ghost of somebody who lived in that era.
Doesn't she? With a little quirky smile and twisted. Yeah. I worked with her briefly on a workshop of a play out in Los Angeles. Out there. And it was a real regret that I never just went up to her. I think I was too shy.
Yeah.
To go up to her and just tell her how much her performance in that thing, you know, blew me away.
Yeah.
We all have
those moments.
I remember I knew very good friends with an actor on The New World with Malick.
Oh, yeah.
And I knew two different actors. One of them was a younger cat, and he loved the experience. And Malick incorporated him to help also. He was not only acting in it, but he also had a dance background. And so he helped devise a language for the people in the film so that they would...
The physical
language? Yeah, physical language. So that they would, you know, incorporate the deer or something out in the woods where they were hunting. And it was really fascinating. And it was something that Malick kind of just developed as it was happening. The other actor said... I ran into him at an award ceremony, and he said, "You know what? That guy's crazy." And that was the end of the conversation, you know.
And this is the older one.
Yeah, it was the older gentleman.
That's amazing.
Yeah, he just didn't want to have anything to do with him. He was writing him completely off, you know. But I think, in a way, you know, to sort of bring it. I think that's what I liked so much about the making of the Drawer Boy, was that it. It was very lived in too, and it was not a large budget, but what they were able to create, and we as a company and cast and stuff, it felt very lived in.
Right.
That's what I enjoy so much when I've seen the film. First time I saw it went down to there was a screening of it in a film festival in Indiana, Heartland Film Festival, and I got, you know, taken down there. I went to see it, and I wasn't quite, it was the first time I'd really seen it, and I'd seen parts of it, you know, on a small computer when at home, and I was going, I'm not sure whether I'm okay with my own stuff.
Sure. And,
you know,
it's a different relationship.
Yeah.
Seeing something in pieces and small, and literally small sizes like that.
But I seeing it in this in a large cinema and stuff, and with an audience, was really telling, and that they were enjoying it, and they went along for the ride, and then were taken to places that I think they weren't expecting with it.
Yeah.
But it was that lived-in feel, and you know, we all kind of hunkered in and lived. You know, the three leads, Richard and I, and Jacob Eamon, and Richard Clark, and we all lived together. And we could work at night, you know, when we got home after shooting, go with like, we don't need that line, maybe, or how, what can we do here? And so it was, we would show up the next day to shoot whatever we were shooting the next day. and you know, be able to talk with Aviva and Arturo, and you know, run stuff, filter things through them, and collectively, and Cabot.
Yeah, well, a production as small is going to be like a little family, right? Like a little ship that's together all the time.
Yeah, and I had just come out, you know, I shot a bit on a film called It, which was a big, right, enormous budget.
Oh, yeah.
And then went immediately from that off to do this piece. And both pleasurable, but for very different reasons. But this one was, I think I like... it when you have that collaborative quality, mm-hmm. and you can actually kind of really grapple with things and struggle with points of view, and you know, as friends and as colleagues, but really kind of get to something, and not that that didn't happen, say, with that larger film. Sure. That was very playful as well, but
yeah, but it is
but a different way.
I mean, with it, you're dealing with it. I love talking about it because it always, you have to check yourself and say, well, the movie it is this.
Yeah.
It's a machine. Anything that big, anything with effects and with that level of character juggling and you know, multiple locations and multiple, I mean, mm-hmm. with the sequel, we're getting multiple time points and yes, all the other things. There is so much going on at any given moment that there's just, the actors can curl up in a corner somewhere themselves if they're lucky.
Yes. Yeah.
Between setups, but you don't get to interact with the entire production on the set.
No.
I mean, people tell me that over and over again, that the mid-range films are disappearing, so the smaller ones are the ones where you have the opportunity to really
kick out. Yeah,
do something personal and meaningful.
Yeah.
And if you're lucky, you'll get a bigger picture that has room for it.
Yes.
And we're seeing those now. Like, I think people are starting to get comfortable with the idea that you can have performance in a great big studio picture again. Like, mm-hmm. there was a time when that just wasn't allowed, and we're back to it. But yeah, something, I mean, well, to bring it back to Days of Heaven, the idea that this is the thing that Malick wanted to do after Badlands, and that Paramount let him, you know, like, here you go, have some money, go off into the frontier that you build for yourself and see what comes out of it. Like, the idea that this experimental process that he went through was not just accepted, but encouraged at the time.
I mean,
now he can do it because he's Terrence Malick, but at the time he was a guy who made one movie that everybody liked.
Yes. And then he gave him quite a, you know, $3 million or whatever it was to start with, right?
The leap of faith involved.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I have to say that, you know, everybody kind of cans on Cimino's
Heaven's Gate. It's a nice parallel though, isn't it?
But I love it. I go and watch, you know, I've seen that film a number of times now, I guess, over the years, and I find that that affects me in the same way. Not emotionally, but in terms of the way it unfolds and the idiosyncratic things that happen, you know, the roller skating scene in that is like the, you see the old itinerant workers in Days of Heaven tap dancing and doing you know, on an old door that they've ripped off and thrown out.
Just the idea that life, that, you know, people find ways to entertain themselves in the middle of this nothingness.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So you see joy and homemade joy, mm-hmm. Because the soul needs it, I think, in juxtaposition to the toil and the struggle that they have to do to survive.
The constant work.
Yeah.
That's the thing that, another thing I noticed this time through is that it's not just the detail of the work, it's the oppressiveness of it, mm-hmm. that this is what was expected of people.
Yes.
That you would go out and do this backbreaking labor, the men, the women, the children if possible.
Yeah.
Like, everybody gets pulled into it because if they don't, they don't eat, they don't get fed, they don't get paid. And how, just how completely powerless anybody is below the level of supervisor,
mm-hmm.
to do anything other than the job.
Yeah.
And if you get hurt, it doesn't matter. And if you can't do it, it doesn't matter. And just the way that somebody gets docked a day's pay because, or Brooke Adams, right, and her team
don't
line them up properly or something.
I you know, there was a scene, there was a moment where you see that young girl up on the hay bale, and the belts are, you know, from the machinery is going, running.
Waiting for her to die the first time I saw that.
Yeah.
It just looks so dangerous.
Anyone who spent, I spent a fair bit of time in my life on farms and working on farms and tobacco farms, and I picked tobacco as a kid, and, you know, and on my uncle's farm, I lived there and a chunk of time and worked there, and disaster is just always around the corner, and you have to be savvy around those machines or you're going to lose a finger and arm.
Those things are terrifying.
Yeah, and you know, so...
I mean, I'm a city kid. Anything with more than one gear is frightening to me.
Yeah, yeah.
But
you see that stuff, and the expectation that they have to be working in close proximity. Gear has this long coat, flowing coat, and I keep thinking, oh, don't get near those, you know, those gear shafts. Yeah. They're going to take you down.
It was the pitchfork thing for me, the thresher.
Yeah.
Where those tines just keep smashing out and back again, and people are right next to them. And, you know, it's a camera trick. I'm sure everybody was completely safe, but the characters aren't, and that's the danger.
No,
you're just constantly aware of how badly things can go.
Yeah. It reminds, you know, I know that they looked when they were, when the both Malik and Nestor
Almendras,
were working on developing the look of the thing. They were looking at like Vermeer and that and but for me, it's sort of a cross, like between like a Bruegel painting and Thomas Hart Benton's work. Those great murals, American murals of farmers working in the, you know. From the 40s and stuff.
Yeah.
But there's an ugliness to Bruegel's work that I find, you know, that great sort of Flemish Dutch Renaissance painter, where it's there's an ugliness to those laborers in a way. There's something...
it's kind of a rough-hewn thing to it.
Yeah.
It's the sense that they've been damaged and lived through this.
Yeah, and just have to keep going. And yet there's celebration too in it. But not only visually, the colors and stuff that both those painters use, but the combination of what they bring to their work, I find that, for me, that's what sort of speaks to me in Days of Heaven.
Yeah.
I think what drew me, you asked me originally what it was that I loved about the film.
Yeah.
And I think it was, again, a sense of authenticity. Again, having, you know, spent a fair bit of time in rural situations, that's what pulled me in. I thought, they get it. They understand that people's clothes, that they're, you know, are worn, and they're not studio-looking things, that their hands are thick with work and scarred, and I felt that certainly watching it, and I appreciated it.
Yeah, it feels like the answer to a lot of older Hollywood films where everything was just a little too machine tooled and a little too, the costumes were new even though they looked distressed.
Yes,
you know, nothing against The Grapes of Wrath, but it was made at a certain point of time where movies were a certain way.
Yeah,
and this, you know, again, nobody ever really includes Malick in the new Hollywood just because he only made a couple of films in the 70s and most of them were on the other... Like, Badlands came out just as that movement was starting to slow down.
Right.
And Days of Heaven, you know, it was competing with, what, in 78, it was up against...
Deer Hunter was in there, right?
Yeah. Well, that's another new Hollywood film, I guess, with Cimino. But I'm thinking more like there was a second Smoking the Bandit in production.
Right.
The world was already changing.
Yeah.
Close Encounters was in theaters.
Yeah.
Or still, it was holding on. Star Wars and Close Encounters were both still holding on when Days of Heaven came out. And it's such a strange place for this film to emerge from, because the movement was over. They were already turning towards more commercial projects. And
going back to it, you mean? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, back to it, yeah. Paramount made this.
Yeah.
The same year they made... I mean, it was supposed to come out in 77, right, originally, and then it got slowed down in post.
Right.
This would have been out the same year as Saturday Night Fever, which just bends my head in a way that doesn't make any sense at all. How can the same studio... I mean, that's what they did. They made more than one kind of movie.
Yes.
But this thing is so strange and unique and so insistently authentic on some, in a way that, you know... And the other thing, too, it was only 50 years earlier. The period they're talking about was still memory for people. Now it's almost 100 years later, and we look at it like an artifact because of Malick's own reputation as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that, again, it really surprised me to see his style so fully formed in Days of Heaven. I mean, there's not a lot of distance between this and even Tree of Life.
You're so right there, because with a guy who's not had like a lead up, a ramp up, he's just like full bodied. It is pretty incredible, isn't it?
Badlands is a more conventional production, I would say, just because the true crime aspect of it almost makes it have to be that way. But it has the voiceover, and it has this strange melancholy, and it has the fascination with the natural world that defines all of his work.
You're right.
But with this one, it's just like, oh, no, this is what I do.
Mm-hmm.
And you feel it just sort of snap into place maybe 4 minutes in. This is a Terrence Malick film, as we now know a Terrence Malick film is 40 years later.
Yeah.
He was just there.
Aren't you amazed? I am. You know, when you hear, oh, they were actually hoping to get this actor to play this part, and then you hear, you know what, the right guy or the right girl, right woman, ended up playing that part.
Yeah, you can't. I mean, I can't imagine. Even though Gere is a contemporary-looking person, and it's still weird to see him, it stops being an issue after about 20 seconds.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can't imagine anybody else playing that role. He has that weird mercurial thing that he used to do that he doesn't anymore, because now he's older and he's doing different stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not a knock against him. But there was that period from the
Gigolo.
I was going to say, it's why Schrader cast him in American Gigolo. It's what made him perfect for the Breathless remake in a weird way, which, you know, has now been sort of reclaimed as a good movie after being crapped on for years. He could do that weird thing where you could see right through him.
Yes.
And it was an asset as an actor.
Yes.
Like he could play a bad actor, I think is what I'm trying to say.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
You could see him be disreputable and unbelievable and untrustworthy.
Yes.
And he's so good at that. And in this, he's playing someone whose entire life is a performance.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes.
Except when he's alone with Adams. He doesn't ever drop that facade.
No. And you know what I think is quite complex about his performance? He has all exactly what you're saying. And you realize he's by circumstance, he's having to scam all the way through. His life is a scam.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's a moment when he comes back to the farm after being away, leaves her, and she's married Shepherd, and he goes to her. He has a moment where he says to her, "You don't have nothing to be sorry about. I set you up. I made you do it."
Mm-hmm.
And there's such regret. It's very subtle, but you can see that he gets. It's all dropped. The facade is dropped in a moment. And I thought, you know, when I saw that moment, this past viewing, I thought, wow, that's beautiful what he did there.
Yeah, and it's almost like he's figuring it out himself in the moment.
Yeah.
That it's only just occurring to him how much damage he's done to this relationship.
Yes, yes.
Because before that, it was just the thing. It wasn't anything you had to think about.
No, it was, you know, he can get past it. He can compartmentalize his thinking or something to get, you know. But to see the longing for something that he's now lost, it was heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As the young girl's performance, I find so heartbreaking too, when after the first season, you know, the workers have to get on that train and leave, and she's stuck there with a friendship that she's created or had with an older, slightly older girl, and the girl says, you know, see you later, and she jumps on the train and off she goes. And you see this young girl just sitting in the field, standing in the field. And it's the same kind of feeling at the end of the film I have. Such melancholy for what is that young girl's life going to be? And where is she going to go after everything that she's seen and been through? A sort of an aimless...
Yeah.
Aimlessness. And you can tell she's bright, and you can tell she's a smart young thing, but it's maybe unharnessed or it has been unnurtured.
Yeah, well, the tone of the narration makes her sound dazed.
Yes.
Almost. So she's remembering things fondly, but we can tell that she's not fully grasping it all.
Yeah.
The movie is there to sort of bring it all into focus in a way that she's incapable of focusing on. So we get to see what really happened, and she has this pleasant-ish kind of reverie.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just still don't know where she is when she's giving that narration, where the character is supposed to be.
Don't you find sometimes that narration takes you down almost into like Dante's Inferno?
Oh,
like when she talks about, like, you know, I met this guy, Ding Dong, you know, he told me about the life and it was going to be, you know, people were going to burn in hell or whatever. And, you know, if they didn't live right, God looks at us one way or another, you know, you do bad, you're never going to get to heaven. Like, she has that quality.
That's true. There's more knowingness in that.
Yeah. It's almost frightening, the understanding that she has in those narrations, because that's what's going to happen. And when those locusts arrive in the field, you see these farm workers beating this stuff out, and it's almost like they're doing, you know, St. Vitus's dance, like right? It's quirky and it's disjointed almost.
Yeah. It's inhuman.
It's inhuman,
it's this. The scale of the film just suddenly shifts too, because, and of course, some part of my brain is going, oh, that's not CG. They did that. They had to do this because it was 40 years ago and the tech didn't exist to fake it.
No.
They're setting fires and beating them out, and those actors are probably on fire for real. And it's just, it's a doubling of the nightmare that people must have experienced at the time.
Yeah.
Because isn't that bizarre too, that we've reached this place now where for 70 years people would go to see movies and think, oh, that's not real, and now we're parts of our head are fixed in the present, and knowing when we see something that is real, even if it's, you know, an approximation of reality, it's like, no, those are locusts, that's a fire, this is happening.
I know.
It's, and again, his second movie,
so confident and so assured to be able to just ride right through it.
Yeah, and make it incredibly thrilling. Like, it's not just scary; it's an invigorating sequence.
Yes, yes.
Watching the mobilization, watching everybody marshal themselves and fight it.
I think one of the images that always stuck with me was that moment where Gear kills Shepard with a screwdriver.
Yeah,
right in the sternum.
Yeah, and almost just reflexively doing it too. I don't think he means it.
No, but that's what
happens.
That's what I mean about his initial killing of Stuart Margolis.
Oh, whatever, yeah. Margolin,
right? That actor in the beginning of the thing. Again, it was just a.
He hits him a lot though. That's what I mean. I think that's why I'm drawing the difference too.
Right.
The first one is a murder.
Right.
He just beats him to death. The second one, it's an accident.
Yeah.
It's a fatal accident, and it's all the other things he's done catching up to him in that moment, all the reflexive denials and escaping and everything. He just lashes out and that's enough.
Yeah.
And it's heartbreaking because we know both of them so well.
Yes.
And there's that weird, for a split second, your brain thinks, well, it's probably for the best. He was dying anyway. And that's the movie just getting you onto Gear's side for a second.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I finally understand how his mind works. And then we snap back into what's really going on, and it's just horrible.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry. Totally derails the movie, derails the conversation, but it's just like this incredible, powerful moment that springs up, and then you're just left with the carnage. You're left with
with the burnt fields, right?
Yeah.
Everything's just...
There's nothing.
Torched.
Yeah. It's over.
Yeah. Except this young girl who's left sort of to wander the world.
Mm-hmm. And she's the casualty of this murder as well, because they can't stay. There's nothing left.
No.
They have to run.
Her brother.
Yeah.
Yeah. Left to float down, you know, he's floating down the stream. That great image of him going in the water, you see him shot from below. I heard that they shot that years later.
Really?
Yeah,
I didn't know
with
that.
In Sissy Spacek, an aquarium in Sissy Spacek's house, you know, that they, or you know, like they had to kind of pull him out to LA to shoot it.
Oh, I didn't know that. I knew it was a post effect, but I didn't realize it was that far down the line.
Yeah, in just a large aquarium in Spacek's house.
I wonder if they learned that from Spielberg. Shot the Jaws, the boat scene in Jaws when they find Ben Gardner's boat. The close-ups underneath the boat of Dreyfus finding the tooth, those were added, the head coming out. That was in the swimming pool.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, the boat is really out on water, but when they cut to the underwater stuff, it's post-shots. It's all pickups.
Oh, fantastic.
And it would have been right around the same time.
Yeah. Yes, it would have been, eh? It would have been
74, 75.
In fact, I think 78 was Jaws 2.
Oh, God, that's right.
I think it would have been 78.
The fact that those things occupy the same space.
I know, yeah.
Theatrically. So, did you see it on its initial release? Were you able to...
I did.
When you first saw it?
I saw that. I think I would have been... 78, I would have been... I was in university, mm-hmm. and I would have tracked down and seen it. Yeah.
Oh, man, I didn't see it in the theater until I was almost 30, I think.
Yeah.
It was playing forever. It was always in circulation at the reps, but it was always in a crappy print. And everyone would say, no, wait for a re-release, wait for a re-release. And they just never did.
Yeah.
And then it finally, I think I saw it at the Bloor, which was a decent screen at least.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never seen it in 70mm, which was the whole big deal of the special release prints that were created. And it was an event in a way that films of that nature weren't.
Mm-hmm.
And I never got the experience of it. And I always wondered what it was. I mean, just what would it be like to receive this film in 1978, not knowing what you were getting into? And you,
what?
Had you seen Badlands? Were you familiar?
I had not seen Badlands.
Okay.
So, in fact, I had not seen Badlands. I didn't get to see Badlands until actually about 7 years ago.
Okay.
I watched it. Finally, I got to see it. And was blown away by it. I really was. I thought, yeah. Oh God, this is so good. But it, different world and stuff that he'd created. But again, confident, like it, storytelling. But I had been a big fan of his subsequent work. Red Line and New World, the one with Brad Pitt,
Tree of Life.
Yeah. Tree of Life, I loved.
Yeah,
I just love that film.
I'm going to have to go back and check my Badlands episode because I don't want to tell the story twice on the podcast. But I ended up doing a Q&A with Chastain. Didn't talk about his process.
Yeah.
Even when the audience started asking really pointed questions in the Q&A portion, she's like, well, he doesn't like to talk about it, so I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
She was incredibly protective. She talked about things that happened on the day.
Yes.
The scene where she gets the call... In the kitchen,
right,
and collapses.
Oh yes, yeah.
They shot that for 2 weeks, and it was Malik over her shoulder with a camera half the time, or 2/3 of the time, and the other third it was reaction shots. But just they would finish shoot for the end of the day, and she'd be completely wrung out and exhausted. And they say, okay, we're going to pick this up again tomorrow, 10:00, and she just, what didn't you get?
Yeah,
what? And she wouldn't. She stopped herself asking that. She stopped herself telling that story because it would have related his answer.
Right.
So she's
she didn't want to look. Yeah. Didn't want to look
she's
for it.
That protective and just she said that you work with him for 2 days and you trust him for 6 years. Whatever
My
happens,
God.
It's just it's in, on, it's his.
Isn't that nice? Eh? Like to hear that sort of.
Yeah, just a director who can command that kind of loyalty without asking for it.
Mm-hmm.
I find, I somehow know I'll never talk to him because that's what he wants.
Yeah,
and I. It hurts a little because I would love to just talk to him and find out how his head works.
I know, and yet I've made the mistake of talking to, say, sculptors or something.
Oh,
people that I've, like, work I've admired or something. And then somewhere it just, it takes the magic out of it somewhere.
Yeah.
So maybe it's a good thing that you don't get. I know, I do too.
I wonder.
There are people that I go, oh, I would love to sit and just sort of chat for a half hour, an hour, whatever, 15 minutes. But... there are questions. I had a chance one time, Gus Van Sant.
Oh, yeah.
I was just flying through an airport one time, and my flight got canceled, and I sat down, and I said, hey, you mind if I sit here? I didn't, it was just a little, El Pollo Loco or something. I don't know what it was. It was, within the airport, right?
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, please sit down. And I didn't know it was him. And I looked up from where, and it was him. He says, can I buy you a martini? I said, no, man, I don't drink, but he says, can I... He said, well, I'm going to get one. We sat and yakked, and it was right after Elephant came out.
Or 2004-ish, right?
Yeah. It had been out maybe, and I'd seen it. I'm a big fan of his work anyway. Well, we just sort of yakked, and he was the most pleasant.
He really is, yeah.
Beautiful man. And you would walk past him, and I think that's why I ended up sitting at the table with him. Again, it was just like a little coffee shop, whatever it was,
Yeah. No, he's an
airport mark.
Yeah. Unassuming presence.
He was a lovely cat. I asked him about, some scenes or something. We got yakking. I never told him that I was an actor. I just left it at, and just that I had no need to get into it.
Yeah.
And, but he was, I found him to be beautiful. He was a lovely man.
He is lovely. His new movie is the John Callahan.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to see it yet.
I like his work.
Yeah.
So, We've kind of talked about it. We've come around to it with the conversation about the drama, but specifically with Days of Heaven, is there anything, this is the closer question of the podcast is always, is there anything of this movie that you've borrowed or stolen or drawn upon or absorbed into your own creative DNA? Have you used Days of Heaven in your own work?
Not consciously. Mm-hmm. I haven't used it consciously, but I think, again, drawn to things that that touch me, the kinds of performances that touch me, and they, you know, that changes as one matures.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
I find that I'm more drawn by things that are subtle, and I think, you know, there was a period of time where when they first, you know, talked to me about doing this film, the Jar Boy, that I was really reticent to do it. And not because I'm in the habit nor in the, you know, the place to turn stuff down. But I thought I would not justify
really
the material. And I didn't think I could really do a job of this particular role. And I said, no, I don't think so. I think you maybe should be looking at other guys. And I think because I had had I'd never seen the play.
Okay.
I'd never seen Michael's play. And I know Michael, you know, I've worked with him. I know all the people who were in the original production. I knew them, and I knew Miles, who directed the play originally. So I knew of its success. And somewhere I thought that they were looking for something else. And I thought, they'll get me up in front of that camera, and these eyes get pretty dark pretty fast. And I am going to be the wrong guy, and they're going to figure that out about day two. Okay. And they're going to get very scared, and I said I would rather not, you know, have to be replaced than and go through all that and put them through that. So I kind of hemmed and hawed and said no initially, and then we talked about it. Then we went to go to the character that I play has head trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, yes, I'll go. I guess I'll do it. And I immediately called up and went up and was invited to go to this beautiful place called Cheers, which is CHIRS. But it's a place for people with head trauma to congregate.
Okay.
And I started to go and meet them and meet doctors and meet and spend a little bit of time, and I was welcomed with people with severe head trauma. And then I started to go, oh, I can get this. I understand this. This is not doesn't just have to have a light edge to it. It, you know, which I was afraid would be expected of me or whatever. And Aviva and Arturo were both adamant. They said, that's not what we're looking for. We want something with a slightly darker edge to this character. So I said, okay. And then I started to realize the frustrations that people go through living with head trauma, the things, you know, they have visions or remembrances of what their life was like, but they know that that's not what's happening now.
Right.
And so that started to kind of open up the world for me. And then I could make it more realistic for myself, really. And hopefully it's worked out in the film, you know.
I would think so, yeah.
But it was that lived-in quality, I think, that I wanted to have. And also having had an experience living on a farm and working on a farm and stuff, that I wanted to make sure that that part of the story was authentic feeling. And I could tell even immediately when we started to try costumes on and look at costumes that Arturo was going, yep, nope, that doesn't work. That doesn't work. And what he ended up getting, I think, was the way people look when they're on the farm. It's not, you know, the clothes aren't overall bibs,
right,
necessarily. It had an authentic feel. I could begin to smell it. And that's what really started to draw me into when we started to kind of put it all together. And, you know, Cabot had a beautiful look to the film. He bought this thing. He had this lens called a tobacco lens, which he popped on. He found and could start to construct the look of the film. But it was to make it look somewhat like those old Polaroids from the 70s.
Oh, yeah.
So well, he sure, had a certain lens on it.
Yellowing kind of.
Yeah,
effect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And,
I've never heard of that.
Yeah, so that kind of... all those qualities I started to see the artistry come into the piece, and that they were on to something that was going to be hopefully very special. So I think that's kind of what, you know, hopefully.
So it's the authenticity. It's
the authenticity of it. Yeah, the authenticity of it. Also allowing things to sit. Allowing scenes to sit and not feel that you have to kind of keep moving the dialogue. You have to keep moving, you know, the action. It's not, a whole lot of action in this piece. But there are scenes that are, that within it are compelling and move, but in a different way, in a way that allows you to sit with the characters and then get to know them that way. Hmm. And I find that that's what drew me to Days of Heaven. And I think that's, you know, in terms of this particular piece, Drawer Boy, makes me feel proud of it.
Yeah. So there's a resonance.
A resonance. There's a
feel that,
yeah,
that's something that pulls you in.
Yeah. Yeah. And the juxtaposition of moments of joy and celebration, life's celebration, and the moment and then moments of real getting down to business, you know, profound moments, I think.
Proper drama,
yeah.
My thanks to Stuart Hughes, who you can and should see in The Drawer Boy, now streaming on highball.tv. Thanks also to Winnie Wong. She knows what she did. Stuart's not on Twitter, but you can follow The Drawer Boy at Drawer Boy Film, all one word, and you can find Days of Heaven in an exquisite Blu-ray and DVD edition from the Criterion Collection. It's also available on iTunes and Google Play, but really, Criterion Blu-ray, only way to go. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at nowtoronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at someoneelsesmovie.com. If you feel like leaving a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or wherever you enjoy the show, that would be greatly appreciated. Every little bit helps. It truly does. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening.
All of those, I'm afraid you're just too darn loud.